the business is changing at an exponential rate. And if you're like me, there are far more questions to get answers to than you have time in the day. Each week, I sit down with a unique guest and get their perspective on something interesting in business. It could be something I'm trying to learn, a topic we're seeing happen in the world. It could be demand gen, artificial intelligence, go-to-market, strategy, branding. I get curious, and I'll go lots of places. I hope you enjoy listening to these conversations as much as I enjoy having them. Before we get started with today's guest, please make sure you like and subscribe.
Hello, welcome to the summit.
Now, I'm your host, Kyle, onto the show.
Back with another fun episode. Actually, I'm very pumped for the second episode. Today's guest is David Brashears. David refers to himself as the chief revenue mechanic. And what's awesome about David is David has lots and lots of years of helping outbound motions, AEs, SDRs, BDRs take over the world. And today we're going to talk about all things as it relates to the SDR, BDR, inbound, outbound, what's the best way to get the most out of this team. Welcome to the show, David.
Hey, thank you. Great to be here.
We're excited to have you. So before we get into kind of the nuts and bolts of what we want to talk today about the SDR team and how that world's changing, tell us a little bit about yourself, where you've come from, how you found yourself in a role where you're super passionate about this outbound motion.
Yeah, it was entirely accidental, I assure you.
So I began life not
in fact, I didn't have my first sales gig until I was almost 41, 40 years old. I began life as a debate coach, believe it or not. I was the coach at the University of North Texas, and the University of Texas coached the intercollegiate debate teams for like almost 20 years. So that was kind of the first half of my life. I was going to be an academic. I was going to graduate school, doing research, teaching public speaking to undergrads at UT and Houston Tillotson University, and kind of on this path to become a professor. And as I was wrapping up my dissertation and about to complete my PhD, I had a kid. And I don't know if you have kids or not, but it's a very sobering experience, one that makes you kind of look at your checking account and go, shit, I don't know that I can afford to be an itinerant professor. And by that point, I was mid-30s. So did a couple of business things, figured out that I was not going to be a business guy. I owned a company briefly and ran it into the ground in 2008 during the recession. Was like, okay, there's a ton of shit I don't know. And a buddy of mine was like, look, man, you coach debate forever. Like you answered objections, you defended value propositions, you were built for speaking. Like, you ought to try the sales thing out. And he was a sales recruiter, of course. Got a SaaS company in Austin to take a flyer on me as a 40-year-old PhD dropout SDR, like, which is just like that is resume gold right there. Like, who wouldn't want to hire that?
It's like the tech version of beauty school dropout.
Yeah, dude, it was bleak. And I was grumpy. I'd been a boss for like, I'd run this, you know, University of Texas National Institute in Forensic. I was director there for like 15 years. And suddenly I was going to go entry level at some place. I'd been managing like 20, 30 people. It was an entirely different world. But luckily a guy named Justin Crandall took a flyer on me and I became an SDR. And shortly after that became an AE. And then kind of have had the past 10 years, my career was an enterprise account executive working largely at early stage startups, helping them figure out go-to-market and product market fit. Landed at a company called Outreach I was employee 226. I know that because they gave us jackets with the number on the sleeve, and I was very proud of that. So it was there from about, you know, after the 10 million to 25 million ride, took it to 100 million. And when I left, I went to a company called Sapper Consulting and founded the professional services practice. And I went there because one of the things that I discovered at Outreach was we sold this really incredibly powerful tool, but folks didn't really understand how to get the most value out of it. And a lot of them were doing really messed up things with it. And there were a lot of problems that needed fixing. And so that kind of became my mission, was I was going to help folks who had invested in sales engagement technology, like Outreach and SalesLoft and Groove and others, really figure out how to maximize their return on that investment. And so that's what I did for a couple of years till the company was sold. I went out on my own and have been for the past year and a half trying to find the best position from which to help organizations make change. So I'm a revenue mechanic because I work on revenue engines. I help you figure out what's stuck and how to make it go faster.
Well, I think
that was long-winded. That was just long-winded as hell.
We got in the Wayback Machine and we got a nice little short clip there. That's fantastic. Now, I do... It's so for everybody listening here, you talked about the arc of being a 40-year-old SDR entry level, kind of getting the world under your feet. But I also think you have a unique position because you came in with a lot of pre-developed skills that you could then apply, and you know, hopefully it helped accelerate your career in the ways that it did. What is it holistically that people get wrong about the SDR, the outbound outreach motion today? Like, if we just start with what's broken as kind of the floor.
Yeah, that is such a good question. I hate saying that's such a good question, because usually it's not. It's just but that is such a good question, because I think a big part of it is that we're very fascinated with this idea of doing things fast and cheap. Right. And we're really big fans of acceleration and automation. And I think the problem with the SDR function today is that folks are looking for the cheapest way to very quickly do things, to move at scale. And so things that were very thoughtfully built, like outreach, that were intended to be these engagement platforms that you could use to have very targeted one-to-one conversations with incredibly specific people, wound up being turned into these email blast cannons that were just, they turned salespeople into email marketers. And I think the problem with sales development today is that there's a view of sales developers and SDRs that says that's their job. They are these low value, high volume, transactional creatures that just, you know, carpet bomb a particular segment of the market and in order to deliver very low value opportunities. And I think that's a shame, because when I got into the business, it was very different. And SDRs were viewed as these incredibly insightful analysts who were able to understand what it would take to penetrate an account and then go get them from scratch. And that was kind of the mentality that I brought to it, because that was the way we were taught that the role was meant to be. And I think we've lost some of that.
That's an interesting piece, because you're now starting to talk about segueing here into what an actual good motion looks like. So what is an SDR, an outreach motion? What does it look like when it's at its best versus the carpet bombing that we have when it's at its worst?
Yep. And I'll tell you why, where I say this from. So at Outreach, I had the advantage of being on one of the best outbound SDR shops in the history of outbound SDR, right? So the Outreach team was kind of unique, except it wasn't. The same things that we saw from companies like Discover.org and Zoom Info and Zoom and all of these companies that were using the Outreach platform to succeed were all doing a set of things in fairly common fashion. And the things that they were doing in common were the opposite of what we see being done by a lot of folks today. It was not designed to be a sales acceleration platform. All of the companies that were doing it well were slowing down and using the platform to thoughtfully engage an account, usually using an account-based motion, meaning they were moving towards persona-based prospecting. They were starting to think about account penetration, especially at the larger mid-market to commercial to enterprise accounts, being something that was going to require multi-threading. You were going to have to engage multiple members of a buying committee. You were going to have to engage people of different levels of authority. You were going to have to invest time, because it wasn't even just going to be one sequence. It was going to be a multi-month engagement to line up with their needs and buying timelines and everything else. And so the platform, when used properly, and sales development, when done well, is a very slow, intensive, intentional, highly researched, well-targeted, well thought out engagement. It's a thoughtful pursuit. It's hunting with a rifle instead of hunting with a machine gun.
I'd never thought of it as hunting with a machine gun. That's a very interesting visual.
You can do that in Texas. You can come down here and we will let you hunt hogs from a helicopter with an AR-15. You can just, you know, mow them down, but it's a terrible way to prospect.
Carpet bombing and a machine gun hunting.
Sorry, I'm a little militaristic this morning.
I think they're good visuals. You know, I was speaking with Brent Adamson from ecosystems.io a couple weeks ago, and we were talking about how the sales motion, outreach, you know, outbound, a lot of those pieces really haven't changed in the last 25, 30 years. Like, they're predominantly the exact same techniques. But what we're seeing now is that there's a dramatic shift in how customers want to buy, how they want to consume, how they want to be engaged, the information that they have to be able to be educated before I needed a salesperson to bring me on that journey. Now I, you know, I feel like I have enough questions to at least get the ball started. And I want to start with a, you know, a conversation on equal footing. When you think about the, that impact and you think about the SDR motion, what are the ingredients going to be for success as we move forward?
I think one thing is to, whenever we talk about the shift in consumer behavior, I think we have to be very careful that we don't make the mistake that a lot of folks make. A lot of folks look at the way D2C sales goes and says, look, we do a lot more self-service. We can buy things with a single button. It's a single click. We make decisions very quickly. And then we transpose that into the world of business and go, this is how business buyers now expect to be able to do business buying. Well, there are a couple of problems with that. One is, typically, business buyers don't get to click the one click button because there are 8 or 10 other people that have to weigh in on any consideration, right? So at the outset, we have a different sort of level of expectation about how automated this is going to be. The second thing is it presumes this sort of model that a lot of people are moving toward where they say we have to be more customer centric and we have to let the customer come to us. And if they don't come to us, then, you know, we missed them. Man, you better hope that you're in the 2 or 3 companies that make it into their self-sourced evaluation, because when I'm left to my own devices, I'm going to go find the 2 to 3 industry leaders. Most companies that are vying for a customer in any given market segment aren't in the 2 to 3 leader segment. If those folks haven't reached out to you inbound and they're in market and you don't go interrupt that conversation, you're not going to get bought. You're seeding that business to someone else. And so I think while it's true that consumers have a lot more power and a lot more expectation that they can do things, and we should definitely empower them to find as much information on our website as they can to make them feel as formed as possible to get them to want to engage with us. But in the event that they don't, we've still got to be able to go meet that consumer in a place where they don't expect to have a conversation with us. Interruption is the SDR's job, right? If they're coming inbound, anybody that raises their hand and says, I want to talk to sales should never, ever have to talk to an SDR, period, full stop, right? That person does not need an SDR to go act as a glorified appointment setter for an AE. Ship that straight to an AE. An SDR's job is to talk to people who have not invited a conversation with sales. Interruption is the business. Right. And so while it's true that customers have a lot more power, and while it's true that customers expect a lot more self-service, the existence of the SDR is because some subset of those customers are not going to wind up coming to us during that evaluation. And we have to go pull ourselves into that conversation. Did that veer too far afield from what you were expecting?
No, actually. Well, I mean, the part that I think is interesting, though, because I I've chatted about this several times, but you have a philosophy of what actual good outreach looks like. And what we see coming in on most SDRs is a, to your point, of carpet bombing, leaning heavily into emails. It's a show up and throw up, spray and pray type strategy where, we're grenade fishing, hoping to just get whatever ends up, raising to the top when we throw the grenade in the water. You know what I mean? Like
that's right.
And then they follow it up with unintentional or unthoughtful, hey, did you get my last 13 emails in a row? Well, I ignored the first one. Yeah. Like this isn't what I think good SDR looks like. This isn't what I think good interruption looks like. So maybe instead of, we're talking about the D2C, the direct to consumer, we start talking about B2B and you're taking this account-based approach. What does good outreach look like? What does good technique look like?
Yeah. I boil it down to this. Good outreach is designed to get a prospect to talk to you on the phone, right? And there are a couple of reasons for that. The email box has been just eviscerated. In terms of being an effective communication channel, if it ever was one, it certainly isn't now. All of the folks who were faced with the problem of email deliverability being hurt whenever they spammed, instead of deciding not to spam anymore, they went and figured out how to architect their email structures or infrastructures in such a way that they could avoid that, still get their spam into the primary inbox. That channel is just swamped. So that's one problem. Two is, even if you can write that better email, if you invest in Lavender or Reggie or anything else, and you write just a super awesome email, one, we typically do it super early in an engagement. It's like the first thing right out of the gate. And most people are not going to invest time on your very first touch, right? So we still need sequences. We still need to invest time to be able to be effective. Two is, if you're trying to get an answer in email and getting somebody to reply to you, it is much easier to say no in an email than it is on the phone, right? We know this about mediated communication. One of the great things that I got to do in the early part of my career was study how humans are persuaded and what humans like to do to communicate effectively. Effective communication was kind of my business. And in sales, effective communication doesn't just mean getting a reply. It means getting a reply that's likely to be positive and lead you to the outcome that you want. And so with an email, you're more likely to get a negative reply. And if you get a negative reply, it's harder to overcome that objection because it's an asynchronous channel. I have to hope that you will read my reply back. If you tell me no on the phone, one, you're less likely to say no. If I ask you some small asks, you're more likely to give them to me. And two, if you give me an objection, I can answer it right then and there. And I'm going to get a reply back to you. And I'm in a conversation and exchange, right? So there are a lot of reasons why we don't want to make email the predominant mode of communication. Instead, use your email as a way to get your phone calls answered. Use them to demonstrate your credibility, your understanding of a prospect's world. Use it to establish that you understand the problems that matter to them, the priorities of the company, what it means to their business to not be able to solve it. Share with them information that's educational. Earn their attention by generating curiosity. And the goal is not to get them to reply to that email, it's to get them to pick up one of the many phone calls that you'll be making in the course of the sequence. Right. And so it's not the first call. It's not the second call. It's not the third call. You get your connections on calls 4, 5, 6, and 7. And so all of the emails that are leading into that 5th, 6th, and 7th phone call are all driving them to have more curiosity and interest and belief that you're someone worthy of engaging. That's what good outbound looks like. It's an SDR earning the respect of a prospect to say, this is a person who I want to have a conversation with about this problem that I need to solve. If you're right about the problem hypothesis, and you're right that that person owns some aspect of making decisions about it, you'll eventually get their decision if you prove that you're worthy of that conversation. That's good outbound.
And I noticed that you say conversation and not demo.
Yeah. God, demo. I hate... One of the worst things that happened to sales was the idea that we have these stages, and stage one is discovery and stage two is demo, as if we have this sort of conversation with a prospect where we ask a checklist of questions, and then the demo, we go show all of those things. And I don't think that's how it really works. My experience has been that the very first, when you're going outbound, let's also caveat this. If somebody comes inbound to you and says, hey, I need to buy the G46 and I need 32 cores, and then yeah, go have that conversation with them and show them that you got all the bells and whistles. But for an outbound conversation, you're starting a discussion with someone who did not ask you to have a conversation. You reached out to them and said, hey, do you have a problem? I think we might be able to solve it. Right. And you hope that they were curious enough to say, how do you do that? And then you were smart enough as an SDR to not tell them, but to say, well, if you give me 30 minutes of your time, I'll set up a conversation and we'll talk about that. Which means the expectation on that first call is that the discovery is more about the prospect discovering why they should continue having a conversation with you. The goal of the initial call is not to discover enough about the prospect's problem that I can give a meaningful demo on the next discussion. The goal of the first call is to get the next call. And the way that you get the next call is by demonstrating enough fit to be able to say, hey, does this seem like it's worth a deeper dive? Right. And then that could be what we call a demo. But even in that deeper dive, what you're really doing is more discovery. That's your actual discovery call, where you actually get to show them things and say, hey, you told me this was a problem. If you were able to do this and then show them a little bit of your demo, what would that mean for your business? How do you currently do it? What do you think that does downstream? If you could also do this, show them a little bit more. How would that start to impact this over here? That's a discovery conversation where you're tying the things that your platform does to the problems that they have and making those connections visible in their mind. We have this idea that it's do discovery, come in, show them the product, and then they go, great, I'll take three. And that's just not how buying happens.
Well, especially not in a modern mid-market enterprise where today you're going to have 3 to 7 people on a buying committee.
Good God, trying to get these sales, we're so vested in this idea of acceleration that we forget that if we would just slow down and take the proper steps, we can radically condense how long these deals take. Because what's happening is we're flying through the first couple of stages, and then we're parking for long periods of time, either in the middle or at the end when we realize we haven't actually talked to all of the key stakeholders. We didn't actually engage all of the people that needed to have buy-in on this. We didn't get all the approvals. We didn't even know because we were so fast on the front, we just ground ourselves to a halt in the back. And I want to see a slowdown on the front end of these engagements to earn the credibility and trust of the prospect so that they'll open more of those doors and let us know where the landmines are, who else we need to talk to, where the skeletons are from the previous investments that are going to screw us at the, you know, 11th hour. That only happens if we have trust, and you only build trust by going slow and building credibility at the early stages of an engagement. That means it's about conversations. It's not about demonstrating value, right? It's first about earning trust that they'll even trust what you show them.
You talk about this and you talk about the credibility, and we take, and this is not meant to be disrespectful to anybody that sits in this, mm-hmm. in this position, because it's one of the hardest positions, I think, inside a business today. We give the most difficult position to the least experienced people. And then they're not well-trained or well-equipped. Like, we send them out there kind of like barbarians with clubs and pitchforks and ask them to bring home a king's ransom feast. What is it inside of that role? When you think about it, what is it that makes us want to go younger, cheaper? And if you do go younger, cheaper, what are the tools you actually need to equip them with? What's the way you need to do the training? What's the way you need to think about how to develop them? I mean, first of all, you probably need a certain personality type, but then even beyond that, you can't just have a personality type and then set them into the market. Like, you've got to give them some directional understanding. How do you marry, well, I need more product knowledge with the type of outbounding that you're talking about?
Ooh, this is the $64,000 question, right? Because I think a lot of folks look at successful SDR organizations and miss all of the work that's going on. It's the duck, right? The duck looks very calm and placid on top of the water, and beneath, the legs are just going crazy to keep it afloat. And I think a lot of folks looked at sales development organizations and were like, man, they just hire these kids out of college. These guys generate $40 million in revenue. Boom, this is a model that works. And what they missed was all of the support that the successful organizations are providing to those reps. And I'll use Outreach as an example. At Outreach, SDRs did not come in and start writing their own sequences, right? That wasn't a thing. When you were an SDR, you came in and you had a very prescribed way that you were going to run your day. Here were the accounts you were going to engage. These are the prospects in the accounts. Here's how many you put into sequence. These are the sequences you're going to use. Here's how the messaging works. Let's get you on the calls and let's now watch you go through what was a fairly scripted exercise, because we had very persona-based sequences. So all you had to master were the problem sets around a specific set of personas and a specific subsegment of accounts. Right. So it made it fairly easy to teach the motion. Every day they were doing relatively the same thing. They weren't every day coming in and deciding to go after a new industry vertical and deciding to go after new personas and writing entirely new emails. Let's try some new messaging. What the? No, these people are right out of college, and you want to, you know, give them guardrails. So that's one thing. Every company that did this successfully that I got to watch did it with guardrails on, included things like, you're going to use shared sequences. You're going to have a prospecting plan. There are going to be guardrails and guidelines for how you engage these accounts. So that's the first thing. The second is they all had good managers that were able to effectively coach, not just to activities, but to deficiencies and skill sets. So were you not good on the cold calls? If the whole point of this, if all of the companies that are doing this well are converting at least 3-to-1, their meetings are being booked on phone call touches, not email touches. That means the place that a manager can have their biggest impact is in coaching reps to be successful on cold calls, or on the calls, warm calls, whatever you want to call them. Right. And so that's the second thing, is they had managers in who weren't just counting activities, but were able to correlate those activities to deficiencies in performance and then find the place that they could actually have a meaningful impact on performance, helping them get better at the call. Right. And so those are the things that I think you have to have in place before you go hire. Yes, you should definitely be hiring 40-year-old people like me that are making career changes. You should be hiring bartenders who can have a conversation with anyone about anything. You should be hiring analysts straight out of college who understand remarkably well how to identify patterns and to identify, right? Like, there are a lot of skills that go into being a good SDR. I don't think you hire one specific type. I think you could teach the motion, and people are going to bring different strengths. Some people are going to be highly analytical and less conversational. Those folks, you're going to have to teach how to get comfortable on the phone. Some folks are going to be fantastic conversationalists, but don't have any process discipline whatsoever. And those folks, you're going to have to spend time developing that process discipline, right? So I think you should be willing to hire a broad range. And I don't think there's one set of talents that automatically makes you good. The one thing that all SDRs have to be willing to do is pick up the phone and have a comfortable conversation with someone who is not expecting your call.
That seems to be like the core component. And yet that, you know, what is it? Phone apprehension, phone phobia. That's a, I mean, that's a real thing for sales and SDRs.
Well, and we did this really dumb thing when the pandemic hit. Everybody said, oh shit, phones don't work anymore. People aren't in the office. Therefore no more work phones. People don't use phones anymore. And I was like, God, what? Like, do you really think that companies were just like, hey, y'all, just go on home and don't even worry about checking that voicemail? Like, there's this assumption that, like, people don't actually use their business phone to conduct business internally. Like, it's only a sales channel. That's ridiculous. People forwarded their phones to their mobile phone. It made it easier to connect with mobiles, but still be calling from a business number. People called in to check their business voicemails, meaning the biggest thing that you're doing in a sequence. If it takes 6 phone calls to connect with a prospect, 5 of those phone calls are voicemails. Those touches that you're delivering are your voice. They're the human connection that complements the emails and complements the engagement on LinkedIn to make them eventually pick up the phone. Right? If they're not in the office anymore, but they get 5 of those voicemails and you do your job, they'll answer one of those emails that's a bump and give you your call, right? So the point is, the phone still works and the phone still worked, but too many organizations gave reps the excuse to say, oh yeah, we can't use the phone anymore. And that's when we saw the massive barrage of emailers that happened to coincide with the spam filters kicking up and people finding themselves in the spam folder more. And so we went and re-architected our email architecture. So now we could have 100 domains and send just massive bullshit spam everywhere. Like, that was the mistake. And that's where I think we went off the rails.
Well, you talk a little bit here about, you know, good habits, and Ethan even nodded into a little bit, but you genuinely believe that there's an impact based on, you know, the repetition. And I've heard you say before, mm-hmm. and you've posted on LinkedIn, you talk about kind of the stacking effect, and that 90% of an SDR's job is just doing what they're supposed to do when they do it. Yeah. Why is stacking so important?
Think about this. In marketing, we all understand that a customer goes on a journey. We don't go from customer sees product, customer pulls out wallet, right? Customer has to go from awareness to consideration to evaluation to negotiation to purchase, right? And then B2B, it's a little bit more complicated, but essentially we have to take somebody through the same things. Well, when you are going after an outbound prospect, you are starting from a point of potentially pre-awareness. For a lot of companies, they don't know who the hell you are or what you sell, right? For many of the companies that I'm talking to right now, you have no choice but to do outbound because you're either bringing a new product to market, you're carving out a new category that doesn't yet exist, or you're competing in an incredibly crowded market where you're just one more of many people vying for attention. You aren't known yet. So you're starting from a point of unawareness, and yet you're asking, will you book 30 minutes of time with me? Booking 30 minutes of time is not an ask without some risk on the part of the prospect. Anytime a prospect agrees to talk to a salesperson, they are putting themselves at risk. They're risking their political capital. They're risking that this person is now going to be just hounding them and the rest of the organization. They're risking exposure. If they bring a bad, you know, vendor into the ecosystem, then that's going to be a hit against them, right? So it's not without risk that someone agrees to talk to you. So you take someone who is at the pre-awareness to awareness stage, who has a vested interest in not talking to you, who is predisposed not to just pick up cold calls. Very few people get their jollies answering cold calls. So all these things are working against you. Why on earth would it not take sequences, an extended period of time engaging someone to earn their attention? Sequences work because it takes time to go from awareness to consideration. And that's just the point at which someone says, all right, I'll be willing to at least entertain what you have to say, to evaluation. Yeah, I'll take a meeting with you and we'll go ahead and start this because I know exactly what you want as a vendor. And I know what giving you 30 minutes of my time means. It means we're doing this. We're having a conversation. It could go somewhere, right? And so I think it's nonsensical to think that we could just write this magical email that hits that cold outbound prospect in that state of unawareness and gets them to go, my God, I've got to have this now, right? Like, how, what would that email even look like, right? And especially now that the email has to be 50 words long, like, holy shit, where the parameters are pushing in, where you've got to give them massive value in 50 words or fewer. Like, what? No. So it just can't be done.
So when you think about sequences and you talk about needing to stack, then how do you stitch those together to be impactful? I've only got 50 words, or it's shrinking.
Like, yeah. So how do you change? All right. So I'll give you a good example of the stacking effect, right? So the very outset of a sequence, we're going to put someone in a cold outbound sequence. This is someone who we're going to assume doesn't know us from Adam, right? They don't know my company. They don't know my product. I'm new in the space. I'm not Oracle reaching out for a renewal. Right. So this is a new logo. I'm going to assume very little knowledge. My opening move on an outbound sequence is going to be these three steps. The first step is a LinkedIn touch. Right. And on that LinkedIn touch, I'm not going to send them a connection request. Sweet Jesus. This is the very first thing you're going to do with them. Stop. Not going to send them an email because I'm not trying to turn LinkedIn into another email box. All I'm going to do on this step is, one, confirm they're still at the company. You know how old your CRM data is? It's old. And you know how old is? If it's older than a week old, that person may not be in their job. Right. So you got to assume your data sucks. And the first thing you've got to do is say, hey, this, you know, person that I just dropped into a sequence, are they even the right person? Are they still at the company? Confirm their title, confirm their role. If they're not, get them out of that sequence, make the changes in the CRM so you don't go reach out to them again. Go find the right person. Second thing you do, find out if they're active on LinkedIn. If this person has like 10 connections, then every LinkedIn touch that comes up in the sequence, you can ignore it because Jimmy over here is not a LinkedIn person, right? But if it turns out that this person posts and is on podcasts and is all over the place, then holy crap, you need to make a note that you're going to engage heavily with this person on LinkedIn, because this is a thought leader, one, and it's two, someone who you can open up that channel with, not to sell them, but to demonstrate your credibility and understanding. So make a caveat on that. The third thing that we're going to do with this is we're going to give that prospect an opportunity to see us. Because when I go visit your profile, what happens? You see Dave visited your profile page. So now you're going to see David Brashears, right? Second thing that happens, that step is done. As soon as it's done, an automated email fires off. The automated email is automated because it's persona-based, right? So I know that you are a VP of sales, and I know that you're at a mid-market company, and I know that you're in a particular industry, which means I can deliver a fairly targeted problem hypothesis that says, hey man, I'm guessing that given that you guys are doing XYZ, right, as a business in this area, that you probably have challenges around this. Am I right? That's it. I'm not asking for you to respond. I'm not asking for you to give me any time. I'm asking for you to validate that the problem I'm about to talk to you is something that is a problem for you. And what do I want you to do? I just want you to think about it. I just want you to recognize, like, yeah, that dude gets my problem. My goal is that I say something that for you goes, yep, that's the shit I'm dealing with right now. So now you've gotten to see me on LinkedIn, and a couple of minutes later, you got to see me in your inbox the next day. And I wait a day because I want to give you time to see those. I don't assume that you're desperately sitting staring at your inbox or that you're desperately staring at LinkedIn. I want to give you some time for these two pieces to connect. That third step is the next day. I'm going to get up in the morning. I'm going to make a phone call to you. And my phone call is going to start with, hey, Kyle, it's Dave from wherever the fuck I'm from at the time. I sent you an email yesterday. Did you get it? Right. And now it's easy because now, oh, holy shit, you're in a conversation. I don't have to ask permission. And if you say, no, I didn't get it. Not surprised. Email is garbage these days. That's why I'm calling you. I wondered if this is a problem for you. And then you restate the problem hypothesis. Holy shit, you're still in the conversation. The whole approach, that's the stacking effect. The LinkedIn touch makes it more likely they're going to recognize me when they see the email. Not that they're going to respond, but now my name is reinforced that when I show up and if they answer the phone, I've now got context for the conversation. More likely, I'm going to leave a voicemail. But now those first three touches have said, this is David Brashears, the individual who's reaching out to you, not the random name in your email box that's disconnected from anything else. I'm going to give it a day. And a day later, I'm going to make another phone call. That phone call is building off of that recognition that's now only a day old. If I waited a week to make that next phone call, the likelihood that you would recall those three initial touches is slim. That's the stacking effect. The stacking only works by virtue of the recency of the preceding touches to the subsequent touch, right? We also see it in places like, well, I'll pause there. That's an example of the stacking effect and a reason why I start sequences that way.
Yeah, but then that means you can't just spray and pray, because now I have to be intentional about looking people up on LinkedIn and understanding who they are. Like, hold on, that now you've neutered my scalability, Brashears. What are we doing?
You know what I hated the most? When I was at Outreach, one of the first things that they showed us when I got there was, they were like, hey, here's how the platform works. And I already knew, because my old company was one of the very first Outreach customers. And I just knew it as the email automation platform that my SDRs used. I was like, oh, it's Yesware on steroids. This is terrible. Get on the phone. When I got to Outreach and luckily made it through and like figured out that these things were more powerful, one of the first motions that they showed was just grabbing a ton of prospects out of Salesforce and dropping them into a sequence. And it was like, sales accelerated. And I was like, no, dog, no, that's not it. The way that you prospect outbound is by selecting a handful of accounts each day that you want to engage, finding the 3 to 5 prospects within that account that make the best combination of entry points for you to get a conversation started, and then engaging them and doing that same motion on a daily basis. What you wind up doing is, on the first week that you're engaging, you'll do about 5 accounts a day. 6 accounts a day is a good way to think about it. In the second week that you're working, you're going to move down to about 3 accounts a day. In the 3rd to 4th weeks that you're working, you're going to move down to 1 account a day. And the reason is because every time you put somebody in a sequence, you're investing the next 30 days approximate of your prospecting capacity. You are going to have phone calls 3 days from now, 5 days from now, 10 days from now. And so you have to account for that. Every day you can only do so many things. And so the best prospectors are the ones that are slowing down, doing an account-based motion, selecting their targets a handful at a time, and adding them in on a daily basis. It's the worst thing that you can do with a sales engagement platform is batch load a ton of prospects into sequences and just go. You're going to wind up getting folks that are no longer at the company, getting folks who are in different roles, getting folks who just have nothing to do with it. You're going to have a bad match between personas and the messaging that you're delivering. Like, unless you slow down and get target selection right on the front end, you are going to be wasting that 30 days of prospecting capacity that you've invested. Every one of those people that you drop into a sequence that's the wrong person or that's in the wrong sequence, that's wasted effort. And so, again, slowing down on the front end, not accelerating through the most important part of the process, deciding who to engage, that's the trick to upping your conversion.
Well, but I mean, now you're talking about being selective. That puts the onus back on the manager, the marketing team, for helping
RevOps,
the SDR team to know where to target, right?
Yeah. Well, think about this. So, let's say an SDR is using this prospecting plan. They're using Rule 52 from Outreach. It said you can, every account that you engage, I want you to engage up to 5 prospects, no more than 5 from a given account. 2 of them need to be in a director level or above, so champion or decision maker roles for us. They had to be in certain roles, sales predominantly. For a minute, marketing was in there, but we eventually got them out because they were cul-de-sacs. But the Rule 52 said you're going to go engage this number of people. If I was using a sequence that's, let's say, 22 days long, so that's 22 business days. I'm going to use a business day send schedule. So that's 1 month of engagement. It's going to be 17 touches. It's going to be 7 emails, 7 phone calls, 3 LinkedIn touches. If I ask my prospects to use those for 2 high touch prospects, and then I use some medium and low touch sequences for some lower value prospects at each account, I'm going to be able to engage in a month about 80 accounts. In a quarter, I'm going to be at about 250 accounts, assuming a 20% reply rate and a 5% conversion rate, right? So as I'm running people through this and 20% of them are applying and falling out, some of them are getting all the way to the end, 250 accounts a quarter that an SDR can manage using that prospecting plan.
And if
most SDRs have thousands of accounts assigned to them.
Yeah. Why? And so, well, I don't know. That's a good question. But my question here is you look at that. So what would you expect your yield to be for conversations and then your yield to be for demo? So I'm working 250 accounts. Mm-hmm. Should I expect a 10% ratio, a 5%? Like, what should I be getting conversations with?
Ballpark right now, if you were to start from scratch, you're doing a real sophisticated motion in this sense, you've done a good job with your ICP and you're not just spraying blindly. You've identified a good segment of accounts and you've got a fairly targeted message for that segment. That means both by industry vertical and by size of the company. You've done a good job of identifying your buyer personas and you've accurately identified the good entry points, meaning you're not trying to get to the CEO of GE to start a $20,000 software sale, right? You're smart enough to know what an entry point looks like and you've got the right combination. And you have good sequences that follow best practices and you're executing against those tasks, a 3-5% reply rate is what you should expect to start with. Your goal should be to bump that into a 3-5% conversion rate, meaning folks run through that sequence should book a meeting with you, right? The reply rate on those should be somewhere between 15 and 20% of the people that you put into the sequence are going to get back to you with a no, call me back later, I'm not the right person, whatever else, right? So with that math, 250 accounts a quarter, a 5% conversion rate, a 20% reply rate, you can expect to book 10 meetings a month, right? So if you're talking about an enterprise deal, that 10 meetings a month is more than enough to cover an SDR's nut and then some. If you're talking right. about 30 qualified enterprise deals per quarter, who wouldn't want that? It's highly predictable. The math doesn't vary significantly. And the best thing that you can do is either up on the conversion side by improving your target selection and buyer persona identification. As you get better at honing in on who the best starting points are. And I'll give you an example. At Outreach, we used to sell to marketing all the time because marketing loved to take initial meetings. But by the time you get to the end of a deal, marketing never bought. They'd always say, oh, we got Marketo, we got Pardot. You'd be like, no, dude, wrong. And it's because we belonged in sales. We were a sales engagement platform. So we had to stop taking initial meetings with marketing because they were, as I said, cul-de-sacs. You'd go into them and never get out of them. You'd just spin your wheels because it'd smell like an evaluation. There'd be money and everything else. And at the end, the CMO would say, now we got Marketo, right? So if you get better at your target identification, either by focusing on the accounts most likely to convert, or the buyer personas that are the best entry points for a conversation, you can up your conversion rate. On the other side, you can get better at your messaging. You can get better at your sequence construction, at building emails that get phone calls answered, at upping your phone call connection rate. One of the biggest problems people have right now is they're using dialers where your phone number is showing up as spam risk on your prospect's phone. Right. So every dial that you're making is on a rented number, and that rented number now just advertises spam risk every time you dial. What do you think your chances are of connecting with a cold prospect when your interface says spam risk right on it? Right. Like it's the functional equivalent of delivering your emails to the spam folder. But I find almost no companies are talking about this right now. But those are the two places that you can have the biggest impact: better targeting, better execution.
So when you think about better targeting, well, before we think about better targeting, let's talk about better execution. What is better execution? Like if you're going to work on messaging, what does that reach out look like? What is the, you know, what's an example of the, you talked a little bit about the, mm-hmm. the voicemail a second ago and stacking that, but what is that original email? Like should I show up and start talking about features and functions of my product and the things we save? Should I start talking about all of my relationships I have? Like, how should I start this? Yep. How should we actually do this?
So let's qualify this as a cold outbound, because I think one of the problems we have with a lot of recommendations, and I'm as guilty of this as anybody, is that we tend to conflate. If this was a referral, or this is someone who came from another customer, or right, depending on who you're talking to, you should obviously start with however warm you can get in the conversation. But assuming it's pure cold outbound, you should start by talking about the one thing that you have in common with that prospect at the outset. What is that? What do you think that is? It's the problem that you solve, right? The thing that you have in common is they've got a problem and your technology is designed to solve that problem. But you don't have the technology in common. They don't give a shit about you, your company, your product, your customers. None of that matters yet. They will eventually. Like, you'll get to a point in the sales process where all that will matter. But at the outset, none of it does. The only thing that matters is if they believe that you have a genuine understanding of a problem that they have, they believe that you have something to offer in the resolution of that problem, and they trust that you're going to be a responsible partner in that conversation, right? So at the outset, changing what you're asking your sequence to do and recognizing what you're trying to accomplish will change what you do in those emails. You should never talk about your product. You should never talk about how you solve something. The whole way that I get you to want to have a conversation with me is by saying, hey, is this your problem? Is that problem causing you to do X, Y, Z? We worked with this company that was doing A, B, and C. When they couldn't do that, it nearly caused them to get crippled and they couldn't do these things. You want that person to say, how did you help? What can you do to help me fix that? Because that curiosity is the motivation that gets them to pick up the phone. If you tell them, oh, well, we sell a next level CRM that automates the blah, blah, and goes with the schnarty schnar, and this goes, they're going to go, oh, I bought one of those. It sucked. You're now in the category of whatever you just told them you are. Oh, yeah, we have a lead service. They're shit, right? You now just put yourself in whatever conceptual bucket they have vendors like you. If there's some ambiguity and they truly don't know who you are, what you're trying to do, or how you would exactly solve it, or they think they know what you do, but they're not really sure, the less you tell them, the more likely they're going to have to get on the phone with you to have a conversation. There's the old idea that there's an information asymmetry that was the reason why companies used to have to engage sellers. And in the age of the web, there's much less information asymmetry. Now, these days, anybody can go find out your pricing, they can find out your products, they can go read your reviews, they can hear from other customers. All of those things are all true, except you have knowledge from having seen their problem from the 30,000 foot view across hundreds of different potential customers. You've seen their problem through the eyes of dozens of personas just like them, or people like their persona, right? Which means the information asymmetry that you now hold as a seller is a consultative bit of information. You as an SDR have the promise of being able to help them understand a problem from a perspective that they perhaps might not have considered before. And while they may know your product and they may know everything else, if you don't go tell them what that looks like, they're going to have to come to you and say, all right, what does that look like? What have you seen other people struggle with? How have you seen them solve this problem? Those are the questions that motivate. So when you ask, how do I write my sequence? Write your sequence with that being the goal. All of your emails in the sequence should be designed to generate curiosity and demonstrate your understanding of a problem, to build credibility and trust and earn an answer to a phone call. All of your voicemails are not talking about your problem. We know a voicemail consists of, hey, it's Dave from whatever company I'm from, 512-799-1768. Why do I say that? Because I don't know what my number comes up on this phone or if my name is even attached. Sent you an email yesterday. I'm curious to hear your thoughts. Call you back later. That's it. Right? All I'm doing is making a human connection. I want them to hear my voice. I want to be someone who is a human person. When I'm on LinkedIn, I'm not sending in mails. I'm not putting on every comment, you should really check out our tool. It's sweet, right? What I'm doing instead is saying, yeah, that's a huge problem. You know what? This is also big. Have you seen this article? This is super cool. Loved your article on this, right? It's just commenting, liking, sharing, being a human being, and never, ever, ever talking about your product or trying to sell them anything, right? That's what writing a good sequence means. It means your content is designed to drive engagement at the point that you want it, on the phone calls. Your LinkedIn activity is designed to humanize you, so they're more likely to want to answer your phone call. Your emails are designed to generate curiosity, demonstrate credibility, so that they will pick up the phone. Your voicemails are designed to reinforce your humanity, demonstrate your credibility, and get them to pick up the phone. Right? All of it ends on the highest converting touch in the sequence, the one that's easiest to overcome an objection, the one that's most likely to receive a positive response, and the one that most showcases your skills as an SDR. Jesus Christ, we didn't hire you because you're Hemingway. No seller got hired because they write great stuff. I know Nate Nasrallah is probably rolling in his grave right now, and I do believe you have to be a good writer, Nate, but ultimately you got to be a good talker or you are not going to get very far in this business.
You know, it's interesting. I heard two really big themes there that I think are a major challenge. One is that if you're in the position where you're buying what Brashears' book is saying on what you should do as proper outbound, you're going to have to be pretty bold. You're going to have to be pretty confident in standing in the face of scalability and do more and faster. Like, you're going to have to actually, in many ways, burn the boats to protect what you believe is the right way, because it's not what you're talking about is not what we've put into the Apple martini that is the go-to-market today, right? It's like, what does it make it smooth and kind of fun and hip, but it's become cookie cutter. What you're really talking about is being, well, and this is the second piece that came to me, because a lot of SDRs, they join that side of the organization, think that they're going to fast track to AEs. And for a moment, we have a group of AEs who've lost their understanding of how to prospect and have problem conversations because they've been on the backside of inbound and it's just coming in. But the thing that I think is interesting
sucks because of it too.
Well, and that so I was thinking as you were talking, I was like, you really have, like, you think about your career progression, the SDR function, the tip of the spear, you're mastering the problem. You're mastering the problem of the market for each persona. Like, it's your job to understand the problems, the nuanced questions to ask around it, not because you have the solve, but because you have the curiosity to set that up for the person who understands the product. And so in the progression of the career, many people want to start with the product and take that to the tip of the spear, and they don't understand the problem. And then, if you don't understand the problem, you always have product, you're going to have a limit to your ceiling, even from your ability to execute as a salesperson, because the second somebody says, oh, I do X, Y, and Z, you're not curious. You're immediately like, oh, we have this feature, and this feature. And
that's right.
Like, you move from active listening to reactive listening. And I think that one of the misalignments between how customers want to buy and how businesses are selling is that sales used to be active listeners, and now they're reactive listeners. Oh, you have this problem, let me immediately solve with this particular feature. And it's like, well, that's that they're not ready to come to that absolute answer yet. They're still in the problem of discovery themselves, which you go back to what you said, where it's like the customer's as much on their own discovery as you are discovering what kind of budget, authority, time, need do they have. Well, that's a great formula, but the reality is like, I think we put stuff in way too early because we qualify they have a four, or we put it in way too late because we didn't actually understand where they were in their buying journey.
And we hurt ourselves so many ways. We undercut our credibility when we throw a solution out prematurely because one champion said, yeah, throw me a proposal. And we haven't talked to all the other stakeholders who we know have a vested interest in what it is that we're eventually going to do. We're shooting ourselves in the foot. This is the slow down part. Look, I don't care if an SDR knows thing one about my product, really, literally. Like, I do not give a shit if they can basically tell me what it does, as long as they understand the problem that my prospects are dealing with. If they can tell me about the five personas that we deal with, the way that those personas are impacted by the problem that we solve, what it means from their career perspective, what it means from their organizational perspective, what kind of shit they're eating from their boss because this thing is rolling down on them, that's all I care that an SDR knows. And if an SDR knows that, when they do become an AE, they're going to start all of the conversations at that point, which is what you need. And this is the gap that you just described. Because AEs are so used to hawking product, they get very bad at discovery. Keenan yells about this all the time, right? That we're very bad at discovery because we're coming at it from a product-centric perspective. We've got our checklist over here and we've been inbound and we're like, how many of those widgets do you need? Check. And so when somebody comes to us with a cold outbound, we're like, well, do you have a budget? No, that's not good. Do you have an order form? Like, what is there a PO I get? What are you doing? Stop. Talk to them about a problem. Establish that there's something there to have a conversation about. Go slowly to understand who the players are, how it impacts the different ones, what it meant for the business last year, what does it mean for the business this year? Take your time to understand those things, and none of that has anything to do with your product. We are so enamored as sellers with our products that we forget the transition that happened 25, 30 years ago is we all became solution consultants. We all became solution sellers. We stopped being widget hawkers, and we stopped just, fulfilling hardware orders. The software world required us to be able to talk about a differentiator that was much different than Oracle versus IBM, right? Like, this is a lot harder for sellers to wrap their heads around, and there are no more McKinseys of the world to go out and de-risk those mega deployments. And when selling became consultative, it meant we had to get better at talking about problems, not just talking about the features of our products. And I think we've missed that. And I think SDRs are one of the places where we can really fix it. If we train our SDRs right and we make them problem mongers and we make it something where they understand the personas inside and out, think about how much better they're going to be when they're AEs doing discovery on those calls that are being set up by those SDRs.
Well, you think about the mid-market and enterprise motions today. And I was talking to Mark Stuess several weeks back, the CEO of Proof Analytics, and he was talking about how large enterprises now are moving away from the 3, 5, 7 year long contracts on new software purchases. They're looking at it as, we'll run a pilot for maybe a year or two. You know, they're looking for terms because they're trying to de-risk the investment for internal. Because what large organizations are now finding out is that, yes, the software may be able to solve their problems, but that the change management and moving people is more difficult than what they had, you know, originally thought, trying to take on an SAP or an Oracle implementation, that type of cutover. You're talking, you know, thousands of man hours, multiple months, sometimes years. Like, these are big change management investments that you get on the backside. And if the company's not willing to change or to adopt it, then you've invested all of this and your net return is poor, regardless of what the sales team said. And so you think about like that shift and talking with Brett Adamson and his, you know, the buyer journey is shifting. The customers are being more empowered, even in a B2B space, right?
Yep.
How they want to buy software is changing. And then we take them through a software sales cycle. We stick an SDR on them that shows up and vomits benefits. And we're like, well, okay, maybe I'll, you know, maybe I could benefit like that. You have a lightweight conversation. And then somebody's down your throat about budget, authority, time, and need.
Yeah.
And then you have to go internally and try and figure out how to navigate the political waters and get other people on your team. And it's your budget versus that person's budget. And what are we going to get? I think before long, it's like the poor buyer, even your champion, is just exhausted. It's like, I just had this problem that I wanted somebody to help me solve. And instead I got 99 more problems and all of a sudden software ain't one. How do we start? Like, it seems to me like a more intentional focus on the problem and active listening and showing some empathy would actually have a dramatic impact in our ability to support. And if I'm a marketing person thinking about this outreach motion, like, that's the tip of the spear of a brand. That's starting off with a really good experience. Here's somebody that was genuinely curious, really looking at what my problems were, spent a lot of time exploring. I probably over-explained things before they ever said anything about who they are, what they do.
Mm-hmm. I was once told by a boss that I was selling past the sale. And he said that because I get people excited. They'd be like, yeah. And you could just tell they were going to buy this thing. And then I'd start saying things. Well, tell me this. How do you guys normally do this? And I'd start asking questions designed to discover if there were, you know, some hidden obstacles. And 9 times out of 10, they'd be like, oh, well, Jimmy's going to kill this, of course. So and I'd be like, well, shit, we need to figure out how to deal with Jimmy. And if I hadn't asked the question, Jimmy would have popped up at the 11th hour and I would have missed it at a call, right? So I think one of the challenges that we have is that we have to be willing to do a couple of things. One is slow down with these bigger engagements. I think too many times we try to bite off more than we can chew, and we try to do these mega implementations with large organizations where change management is incredibly difficult. My clients have been the Fortune 50s of the world, right? So very large global organizations that are akin to trying to navigate the Titanic, right? Like, you just don't change on a dime. And too many times small software companies are trying to bite off these mega engagements without having anything close to an understanding of what the situation is on the ground. How differently things run with not just within different silos, but within different silos within the silos, right? And so I think slowing down and taking a little bit more of a considered approach in some of the larger accounts would help. I think too is, in the old days when we did those big hardware investments, where it was 3 or 4 big mega giants that you were buying and you had a, you know, big 5 consultancy that was going to de-risk the whole thing, that you would pay more money to the consultants than you would to the hardware company because they manage the change management portion. Innovation is happening in the sales technology world at such a pace that nobody owns that space. There is nobody that can come in and de-risk your outreach, Sixth Sense, Zoom Info, Gong, CRM integration, right? Like, there are people that do that, but there's nobody that can say, I've done 500 of these and they all go off without a hitch, which we used to be able to say in the days when it was just big ass hardware deployments and software was bundled in. So I think one of the challenges that companies have is there's not a service architecture that's built to support customers at the volume that they're trying to bring them on. And we as software companies have to refocus our attention on the change management problem. We are adding new technologies into an already bloated technology stack, and we're offering our very, you know, periscoped view of just our, you know, tunnel vision is probably a better word, our product, without seeing its interrelationship to all of the other pieces of technology into which it's being placed. And we've got to get out of that and start getting to a perspective that again slows down and understands what the implications of these new investments are going to be. And that's I think the mistake that we're making. And as a result, change management issues are overwhelming new tech. I see companies every day pulling their hair out because the promises that they were made just aren't coming to fruition because they can't make the technology replicate what it did on the demo, because the demo is not their environment.
You know, that begs a little bit about the personality component. We go back to choosing the right person to be on the team, looking for what they look for. If you start to look for kind of the ethos, what's the archetype? Or, hey, I'm an SDR, or I'm not an SDR, but I'm not an SDR. I want to get into sales, and I think my natural place to go might be being an SDR. What do I need to have? Like, what are kind of some of the non-negotiables as far as intangibles, but then also what are the things that I can expect that I need to go upskill or go develop or learn?
The one that always floats to the top of every single list that I see is either grit or resiliency. And they're kind of, I think they're two sides of the same coin, that sort of willingness to just put your head down and push through in spite of the negative outcome, is of course the most important. Look, this is the one job in business where you are expected to fail like 95% of the time, 98% of the time. Like, there's no other job in business where we hire someone fresh out of college. You go, here you go, Johnny, you're going to fail 98% of the time. Good luck to you, sir. Like, that's messed up, right? So you got that, and you've got the job where you're most likely to be told to go fuck yourself by a complete stranger, right? That doesn't happen in most other positions within a company. And so I think that you've got to have someone who's got the grit to be able to work through those moments of frustration and the resiliency to bounce back after they're given one of those incredibly negative reactions. I think that the second thing that you need is an ability to follow process. There is a lot, we talked earlier about sort of this, the things that you need to do to make a successful SDR team. And one of the things that we've done is we've romanticized this idea that there are these really exceptional SDRs who just, they can just take whatever technology and make it work, and they do brilliant things. And I think of folks like Sarah Brazier at Gong, and she was a genius and did just amazing things. But for every Sarah in the world, there's another rep who's going to do their own thing and have it be exactly the opposite of what should happen. Whoever invented the double tap, that bullshit move where you call somebody and then hang up and then call them right back, so they think it's somehow an emergency, and that's what you're going to start your sales relationship on, that person is the flip side of the coin to someone like Sarah Brazier, right? And so we need to be able to provide guidance. We can't assume that reps are just going to come in and do the right things. And there's a whole lot of reps who just don't have, they're not self-starters like that. They need guidance. So the second thing that you need is someone who's going to be able to follow a process and have the discipline to work to the plan. Right? Because I think far too often we try to get these folks who are, you know, very free spirited and everything else. And what you wind up with is a completely unrepeatable process. And you don't know if your success is accidental or a result of personality or a result of you actually hitting the right customers with the right message, right? That can be lethal as you're trying to scale out a team. The third thing I'd just say is curiosity. You need somebody who is going to be able to have a conversation with someone. And that means generally being able to ask them follow-up questions. And that you can train people to do that, but there is a natural curiosity that people that are good communicators have. They can sit down next to anybody in a bar anywhere and have a conversation about just about anything, because curiosity gets you very far in life, right? And if it's all about you and it's entirely self-centered and there's not a curiosity about the world and others, this is going to be a really rough job for you.
So you're really looking for kind of an explorer, somebody who's willing to get up, trailblaze, be curious. Yeah. You're talking about people that are the Lewis and Clarks of the world, right?
I mean, think about what does it take for you to be someone who is willing to take a job that you are putting yourself on the line every day in terms of, you know, people are going to view you as interrupting. You've got to have a sense of purpose and mission that you're here to help solve something. And so that may be the last sort of element, but I think it ties them all together. Explorers are mission driven, right? Explorers go out not just out of curiosity, but with a purpose. And I think that's the other thing that makes a good SDR. If you believe that your company is in the business of helping other companies solve business critical problems, right? And you believe that every time you're reaching out to someone, you're reaching out to someone in distress with an offer of assistance that can genuinely help, then every call you make isn't a sales call, it's a service call. And you're on a mission to help solve people's problems. That fundamental mindset shift, I think, will help SDRs be more successful. But I think that's the thing that ties it all together. That's what makes that mindset of the explorer also the one that winds up being the successful seller, because they wind up being those very mission motivated people who can make things happen.
Man, Dave. So if somebody, I mean, we've kind of gone all over the place today. If somebody wants to pick your brain further, you know, I know you've got great material for reading on your LinkedIn profile, but how can somebody find you and engage you as the revenue mechanic for their business?
Yeah. Easiest way to get hold of me is on LinkedIn. Honestly, I've got a website, SiliconHillsRevenueLab.com, but it looks like it was made like a 12-year-old. I like bought the website just because I needed a company so that I could, you know, get paid. Almost all of my engagements are word of mouth and referral. So it's usually customer to customer kind of recommending me to folks. But if you're interested in anything I have to say, follow me on LinkedIn. If you'd like to get in touch with me, drop me a DM. I answer them all. And otherwise find me on SiliconHillsRevenueLab.com. I'll have a book coming out at some point, but, fingers crossed that happens soon.
That's awesome. Well, thanks so much for being on the show today. I found it to be incredibly insightful. I think we could go for another hour or two, but as the workday calls, we got to lean into that. So for those of you listening,
I appreciate it, man.
Hey, for those of you listening, thanks for tuning in. This has been an episode with Dave Brashears. Go find him on LinkedIn. Go follow, read his stuff. I can tell you right now, you'll be challenged as it comes to MQLs, how you stack, how you pick the right accounts, what's broken in sales motion today. There's a lot of great food for thought on his account. And next week, we'll be back with another guest. I'm your host, Kyle Hamer. Thanks for being part of the show today.